member of guests.
As I say, I meant to facilitate a discussion. So if anyone wants to say anything, I guess you raise your hand and I point to you and it gets really good.
How would you, in a general way, maybe it's always specific situations, but how do you keep the rot from setting in as far as the trots? If you have an open organization which is not composed of a majority of anarchist members, what strategies would you suggest for telling people who haven't sat around for, say, maybe 10 years reading the history of the left about these things, and then how do you articulate that to them? Because they're not just going to say, well, Dave, you're saying this guy shouldn't show up, or he shouldn't talk this way, or how are you going to support that?
Well, I think there's a bunch of things. I'd say one of the big mistakes that we made is we said, we're your neighbours, we're against the poll tax, come and join us, anti-poll tax group. I'm not saying we should have said, hey, we're anarchists, come and join us. Mm. But I think there has to be some middle ground. Again, we didn't try and hide our politics. And I sat dutifully outside the local supermarket every Saturday morning with the anti-poll tax leaflets, being the, inveterate bookseller that I am. And there was also copies of Class War or Direct Action, so Southside Against the Poll Tax wasn't hiding,
sure,
at least our politics or some of its members. But equally, we weren't standing up going, socialist worker, fight the poll tax. So, there are variations. I think in terms of, particular, I'm guessing most people involved in groups know who the RCP member or the trot is in that group. And I'm all for sectarianism, tell them to fuck off. And I think thirdly, most normal people who are not involved in politics actually really object to being patronised and paper sold to and led by. Again, during the miners' strike, to give you just another brief example, the anarchists were the only left, for want of a better term, group that had any credibility with the miners, because we were the only people on the picket lines fighting the pigs, whatever, who weren't trying to paper sell.
Right.
And, people are not stupid. The miners are running away from the police, are running out of the police, getting beaten to fuck. And literally people are going, socialist worker! I mean, it's fucking insane. And, again, I would hope that, I'm not trying to be glib about it, but I'd hope that if we believe in revolutionary change and most people get involved in that, we must believe that most people are not stupid. Yeah. And most people can see that. In fact, again, one of the problems, and again, I'm diverging slightly, one of the problems, I think, of the anarchist movement in Britain in the 80s was, despite its better class composition, it actually had no idea how to deal with normal people. And again, I think that's a problem of us then, of us now, and a problem here in America. I mean, one of the problems, again, we had all kinds of people want to join the anarchist movement because of the poll tax, because they saw that we were doing good work, normal, previously apolitical working class people who didn't have beautifully formed politics, who may have used sexist language, who may have been a bit un-PC, who may have, well, we don't use the word fag in Britain, who may have, called people fucking homos or whatever. We didn't know how to deal with that, basically. I remember during the miners' strike, a friend of mine who comes from a mining family left the Direct Action movement, which again was actually largely working class anarchists, who did fucking great work during the miners' strike, again, partly because some of them actually were miners, etc. So because he did really good work, several branches or several young miners, young lads, wanted to join the Direct Action movement, lots of them, tens, hundreds of them. The Direct Action movement literally didn't know what to do. So the Direct Action branch may be, again, let's say Class War Edinburgh is four people. So if 20 normal folk wanted to join Class War in Edinburgh, they wouldn't have known what to do.
Right.
And again, that's a real problem, I think. And I don't have any easy solution to that. But I think we have to be... How do we...
I think as a whole that we're dealing with, in a way, that situation right now, because there's... I don't mean to be snobbish or anything like that, but there's a lot of people who, at this point, I think are starting to call themselves anarchists who may or may not know what that even means.
Sure.
I think it's a big problem.
They're also joining in tremendous numbers where we don't know what to do with all these people. There's just not enough activities. I mean, there's just so many people coming in that now, freshly, in Philly at least. I mean, I know it's happening elsewhere too. where are they going to find housing when they move to the neighborhood, and you know, what new groups are going to pop up. And you announce a spaghetti dinner fundraiser, and you run out of spaghetti in about, you know, 15 minutes, and everybody's standing around with a plate and no spaghetti. You know, it's this line out the door. This is not what we're used to, but it's better than no shows.
One of the interesting things that's happened in this country over the last couple of years is the organizational models from Seattle and the other big anti-globalization actions have given a lot of credibility to anarchist models of organizing. So when the sectarian Leninist wackos show up and try to present their models to a newly forming group, and of course it still happens, and the ISO has also grown tremendously here over the last couple of years, I've found that the example of Seattle makes it a lot easier to make the case for holding on to an anarchist organizational model. I don't know if that's happened in Britain or if other people have had that experience. In some ways, in the last couple of years, it's been easier to fight those battles, but they continue.
You first. In the same way, the anti-globalization movement with its anarchist principles has also had this almost anti-ideological outlook, mm-hmm. where you have the ISO picking up the surplus because we're not out there like tabling with an actual viewpoint, with an actual politics we're putting forward. So like you are seeing these ISO groups exploding and whatnot, and I think that's why now we're finally, people are realizing protest hopping is kind of dying down as like this end-all be-all tactic, and people are starting to go back to their communities to do communal organizing, but they're getting whitewashed because they don't have this revolutionary organization to back them up, so they just get engaged in these reformist struggles, the single issue dies out, they don't know where to go, and now we're seeing groups like NEFAC form that are trying to give a base to that, the Ruckus Collective in Phoenix, the Association of Northwest Anarchists, who we're doing in Seattle, are trying to like resolve this contradiction or whatnot. But I think it's really interesting to see that the political emphasis that these different groups are giving to it, and which one are actually going to speak to the concerns, because I really don't think like any of them that have come along thus far have. I think Dan has done it in its organizational model of like trying to embody direct democracy, but none of those groups are talking about white supremacy, they're talking about class, they're not actually talking about this direct democracy that is being embodied in the principles of organizing, which is interesting.
So you.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo the thing you were saying about how we don't talk about class a lot in North America. Like, I think there's a lot of discussion about anti-capitalism, but very little discussion of class in general. Like, we talk about how markets make decisions for us and how, you know, problems with profit, but we don't talk about how this creates classes of people who benefit and classes of people who don't benefit.
Rams, I was interested in your comments, and it goes to the two previous here. In terms of the successes that you had, and you saw them as single issue sort of oriented, and that was one of the reasons why community resistance sort of worked and then later worked in the poll tax. There's a recent book by Stephen Hart, published by Chicago Press, where he looks at community organizations and the types of language that they use. And one of the things that he looks at in terms of an argument is that single-issue-oriented campaigns will often be successful in the short term, and indeed are. But what happens when it becomes a larger vision is that what's missing is that there is no sort of cultural vision that sort of is attached to that. And what his overall argument is that progressives, and he's sort of just looking at the left in general, he's not sort of focusing on anarchists at all, but what he's suggesting that has to happen is there has to be some articulation of a larger social vision in order to give people who do come from like a Scottish nationalist background, you have to give them some sort of alternative other than just the main political issue that you're dealing with. So it has to expand beyond the political. It has to deal with the cultural and perhaps even the spiritual, and that's where you can maybe bring in church organizations. That becomes extremely complex when you begin looking at the different types of languages involved. Again, it's an ongoing process, but that's one of the things that he sees as really problematic in sort of current organizations and the type of language that they're using.
What's the name of that book?
It's called Cultural Dilemmas of Progressive Politics.
And the author again?
Stephen Hart.
I mean, I've found one tactic which anarchism seems to be better at than most old leftist groups and, you know, most political groups as usual, is that in America, at least, I've found that most people are highly alienated from politics, and the reason they are is because the traditional forms of politics employed by everyone from the Republicans to the RCP are inherently just, like, really boring and distasteful to people who have very busy lives, people who are actually working, or for people who just, you know, would prefer to do something better with their time than go through a six-hour consensus meeting, on which nothing really gets resolved. So I found, you know, tactics, I mean, I know many about England and Reclaim Streets, or Reclaim Streets in America has worked really well in sort of attracting people. And I think one of the prime issues in anarchism is how to keep it sort of something which people find to be a vital statement, how to make anarchism a vital community itself, how to make it new and fresh and exciting almost. Sounds like an advertisement, but it's true. And that to me is something I've been wondering what people in Edinburgh are doing. And as for the lack of class war analysis in America and sort of where's our ideology, I mean, I think sort of, you know, God help me at the day, you know, when we have a giant anarcho-federation in North America which has the ideology, be that the ISC or be that NEFAC or whoever. I think it's what I'm seeing in America happening is that anarchism is adapting itself rather nicely to particular situations, you know. For example, the people in Cascadia, you know, of course, in the green anarchism movement is very well adapted to that particular bioregion, while, of course, something like NEFAC would flourish more in the Northeast. I think that's a strength rather than a disadvantage, because I think that the politics would be more concrete, phrased by NEFAC and, you know, those people in the Northeast, and more concretely phrased by the green anarchists in the Northwest, because you're dealing with two different concrete situations.
I just thought one way of approaching the lack of a, you know, ideological organization in the situation you talked about is for anarchists who are, you know, involved in different activities that are directed at particular issues, to establish a common space, like rent a building or buy a building, and have their own dedicated space for events and meetings to take place, but to exclude from that place any of these parties. The ISO can't meet here. The Green Party can't meet here. Needless to say, the, you know, Conservative Party doesn't need to meet there because they have their own buildings, but you just exclude partisan, you know, electoral politics, etc., and then everything else can happen there, and many anarchist things do happen there, and so that you just have this consciousness that when something comes up, it can just define itself for the time, and if need be, you know, you can just take it further and it can develop. But if you have the space and you have to see to the responsibilities of having the space, you know, taking care of the building and cleaning up every so often and running a calendar so that people don't both come at the same time, it becomes like the A space in Philadelphia is very, people don't think of it, they don't go around thinking of it as a thing, but it's just like in the background, and it's always been useful. And it's been very, very key to building the strength of the movement, just because it's there.
Yeah, just something briefly, and then, I mean, I don't know if I made it apparent, I've actually been living in America since 1994, so I don't know what's going on in Edinburgh at the moment now. As to the matter of partly what you were saying, and I think class is crucial, perhaps. I've already made that obvious. But I think as activists, as organisers, as whatever, I'm probably you know, just repeating what I said before, I think, you know, you said class war. It's not, I think class war happens all the time, firstly. There's fucking horrible attack by the ruling class on the working class constantly. There's always been a class war going on. I think what, as we have to do, and what as primarily middle class people, I say, everyone here bar two people have been to college, that gives us all, I don't believe in the politics of guilt. I do believe that to have a successful politics, we have to be realistic about who we are, how we organise, and how that affects our organising. As I tried to make the analogy earlier, presumably most of the white males in this circle acknowledge that they're white males, and that may affect their interactions, their socialisation, their, because they were brought up in a white supremacist patriarchal society. Well, equally, middle class people benefit greatly from being brought up in a fucking horrible, oppressive, class-ridden society, and to not acknowledge that and to not take that into account and to have that predicate the way that we organise, how we organise. And also I think that kind of lack of class analysis basically writes off the majority of the population, who technically we think are actually both the agents of change and those that need change. I'm kind of rambling, and I actually fundamentally disagree with what you said about different forms of organisation. I think without a structure and a practice and ideology, I think that's been our problem, our kind of failing to date. So you were going to say, and then you.
I was really interested in the idea of like an anarchist vanguard. I've never heard that before. Like, and I it's kind of a jumble in my head, but like, it seems like, I mean, one of the reasons that hasn't taken off, and like it's especially apparent in this group, is that like dealing with issues of like white privilege and class privilege and stuff, and like I don't personally, like I have no desire to take like leadership role in the liberation struggle or whatever. I don't know if it's like you're suggesting that it's a responsibility, or if you want to.
No, not at all. Do you want to speak first?
I just would like to make an example. I'm from Brazil, and during the FTA action, we had like a huge problem to talk with people about the issue, and we tried to join a newspaper, which was another problem because most of the people in Brazil doesn't know how to read and write. And to talk about the issue to them was something that was far, far away from the reality. And then, I'm from São Paulo, I'm talking about on the specific São Paulo, we have 1,500 people in the streets, and most of them was college students from middle class, and because we had like we tried for months to talk with people in the street, and it was pretty hard. We didn't yet found like a way to connect with people, because every time we talk about government, especially like trades made by different countries, they think it's far, far away from the reality, and they can never be able to touch it. But there's a really interesting thing that happened in Rio de Janeiro, and it was just a poor neighborhood, the whole community together, they were feeling oppressed by a mall, a very expensive mall close to the neighborhood, especially because the police were doing protection from the mall, and for that they were like attacking the people from the neighborhood. So they decided to take action, and the neighborhood organized by themselves, and everybody from the neighborhood, they went to the mall one day, and they were like people without shoes smelling bad, and they were like, they would just hang out in the mall the whole day. And that makes like a really big tension between the people who work, like who usually frequent the mall, go to the mall, which was rich people mostly. They felt really bad, but there was nothing that they could do, because they were, the people from the neighborhood, they weren't doing anything at all. They were just inside of the mall, and they stayed there the whole day, and then create like a huge tension between the rich people and the poor people. And there was like totally initiative that came from the neighborhoods, and because of the oppression that they were feeling from them all. Yeah, just like just 2 points I was trying to
shoot. We're way over time. I don't know what time lunch is meant to be or whatever, or What I'm trying to say is not that there is some sort of kind of like white man's burden or, you know, middle class, you know. I don't think privileged people have any obligations. I actually think I don't want to sound offensive for you. I actually don't really care about privileged people and middle class people. I actually think they're largely irrelevant, and change can only come and will only come from people that actually need change. That therefore doesn't mean that we should all go fuck ourselves. But I think it means that if we are going to be involved in organising, we have to be conscious of the privileges that we have, especially if we're going to be organising presumably people that don't have those privileges. In terms of being a vanguard, again, perhaps that's a bad word to use because it has all these bad connotations. What I'm trying to say is, and I'll try and repeat myself, anarchism has always been a minority. Even when it's been a mass movement, those people that are consciously anarchist have always been a minority. Hence, I would argue, de facto, that's a vanguard of ideas. That doesn't therefore mean we are leaders. We didn't... In some ways, we led the poll tax because we helped shape the direction, we formed the first groups, I don't think we were leaders of the anti-poll tax movement, though. And, you know, in many ways, the ordinary people, whoever they are, I mean, we were ordinary people as well, you know, were way ahead of the so-called leaders. I mean, we had people that come to Southside against the poll tax. And again, just to give you another little witty anecdote, you know, the sheriffs have their own offices. We had people coming to our anti-poll tax meetings, regular old people, saying, right, let's go and fucking firebomb the sheriff's offices. Let's go and firebomb the pig station. Where I lived around the corner was a huge police station where people died in police custody every week. Said, let's fucking go and do it. And we were going, we really, you know, what about this new leaflet? you know, but in many ways, you know, they're way ahead of us in that sense. These normal people don't need. And I say, another friend of mine literally lived across the road from the self-same sheriff offices. Their windows and their offices were fucking smashed, were firebombed every fucking week. Someone broke their windows. And it wasn't us, because we know who we are. It wasn't us doing it. Do you know what I mean? And it certainly wasn't the trots doing it. That stuff was happening anyway. You know, in many ways, they don't need us. We need them if we want to have a revolution. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Right, but so there was something you would have done different, which would have been just making the ideology more apparent, not like.
Yes,
okay.
And to the reasons why we're doing it, as I say, to me, the logic of being an organizer is to help empower other people to take control of their lives and to organize. And that's the crucial phrase. We don't want to lead people, we want to empower people to organize themselves. That to me is the role of an organizer. And that's very different from being a leader. I still think that makes us a vanguard. We're the, you know, if you do a training for organisers, in that sense you're being a leader, but the logic of your actions is to create lots more leaders. Do you see what I mean? You know, I wish there was anarchist schools which trained people in organising, or, you know, in the Bay Area, people of colour are very successful. They have schools, they do trainings, they do Revolution 101 kits, they do organising training, they place people with unions. I mean, there are other communities who are very successful organisers and are doing great work. The anarchists are not doing that, which is a disaster, I think, and why we remain completely irrelevant. I mean, to echo what someone else is saying over, I think, sorry, I don't even strike anywhere, was saying, Blair. You know, if for whatever reason the WTO stopped meeting in public, again, it's been this huge upsurge of interest and blah de blah. If there's no more spectacular demonstrations, again, anarchism is going to be where it was 10 years ago again, because there's no structure or organisation that's built. If there's not another demonstration that we're building for, which is exactly what the fucking left does, let's build for the next whatever bollocks, there's nothing there. You know, what happens if the WTO or the IMF stops meeting? What are we going to do? Where's anarchism left? We're left with nothing. In the same way that after the poll tax, after we smash the poll tax, what are we left with? And actually nothing, except a bunch of burnt out organisers. And, you know, we have to find ways to get beyond that. Otherwise, maybe another 10 years will be another great upsurge for whatever reason, which we're unprepared for, and fight heroically, and then, great, you know. I actually really want to see a revolution in my lifetime, for purely selfish reasons. And I want to try to organise for that.
Yeah, I very much agree with the need for organization. On the class issue, though, I think it's to realistically confront the tremendous discrepancies of wealth in the society, maybe the most extreme discrepancies of wealth that have ever existed in this society, we need to also be aware of the fact that we live in a culture where class distinctions have been very consciously blurred, that the people who represent the traditional industrial working class are maybe in this society the people who have most internalized the idea of a middle class image, maybe more than any other sector of the society. And I think in order to address that, we need maybe a much more nuanced way of dealing with class in the society than the, you know, the traditional class war framing.
I mean, I think it sort of also depends where you are. For example, back to the ideology point, I mean, as regards class war, like, you know, I have lots of old class war stuff. It's great fun to, we paste that all over rich yuppie neighborhoods. But at the same point, I think you have to realize, organization is good only if it does something, at least in my mind, only if it does something concrete, only if it actually has some basic purpose. And that if the basic purpose is too narrow, you have a one-issue campaign. But I think the great successes of revolutionary movements have come through providing concrete things. Not newspapers, but, you know, food, you know, clothing, sickle cell anemia testing. I think the anarchist, of all the sort of ideologically based movements, has a better chance of grasping that than, say, you know, their RCP. And I think we need to grasp that. We need to grasp that as quickly as possible, and grasp that with full awareness of the context of where we're living at. You know, people in Boston don't really, there aren't that many trees around, at least not within, you know, vision, but, you know, for people in Eugene, it's, you know, right over the hill. And I think I'm glad that people in both cities have taken that to heart. And I think sort of hoping for, like, newspapers and vast organizational structures without any basis in society, you're going to have a bunch of ideologues talking to each other all day about essentially meaningless position differences and become thus vastly irrelevant to the majority of people.
Right, I'm not an advocate, well, actually, I'm an advocate of class war, but you both said class war. I believe in a class analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't mean class war, the organization or the newspaper. I was never a member of class war. Yeah. But it's because I have a class analysis, and America's a horribly class-ridden society, that unless we accept that and organize around that, and actually organize around issues that actually affect the vast majority of Americans, we will remain utterly irrelevant. You know, most people, for better or for worse, and I'm not denigrating in any way, and I don't want to sound like I'm against, you know, tree sitting and saving the environment and that kind of stuff, but that is not what affects. Well, you know, the right wing have been very successful in addressing concerns of middle America. They're, in fact, the only people addressing concerns of middle America, whether it's right-wing talk shows, whether it's the Christian right. These people have real concerns. They're being fucked. We're not addressing that at all. And their concerns aren't saving old-growth forests, which might be misplaced in their part, but unless we can address their concerns in some meaningful way and offer them vision, solutions, say, look, you're being fucked, here's why you're being fucked, and here's how you might be able to stop being fucked, we're fucked. We're irrelevant. We're a total waste of time. We are just, you know, playing politics or playing being ideologues or arguing about, you know, a tree sits better than class one newspaper or whatever. Again, you're not saying that, but you see what I mean? Unless we can actually start addressing concrete issues which actually affect most people, which we've singly failed to do. And again, I think the anti-globalisation movement actually hasn't made it relevant to most people in America. Whereas a bunch of hands went up.
I feel like such a base of this too, again, going back to the class issue, just comes down to a basic issue too of language that we use. I feel like our language is so inaccessible to so many people, and we kind of have this language that, like, if you're in the club of, like, doing politics or activism or anarchism, you kind of can, like, listen to these different things, know the acronyms, blah, 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 and can follow the language. But that is such a basic part of how you organize and how you do take action in whatever form, and until we start having language that is there for everyone, until we're sitting out in front of a supermarket, you know, like, we have to, it's just such a basic thing, and I feel like we're really missing that. And I feel like that again and again and again comes back to class.
Mm-hmm. But also things like your ethnicity, your culture, your gender also affect your language.
Sure.
Just to throw it out there,
sure,
just
definitely.
As much. There's this tendency lately to react against anti-organizational with this class reductionist analysis, I think is really problematic because, like Brian said, most people don't identify as any sort of class. They're not class conscious. And the class stratification is so complex that, like, it defies, like, the earlier, like, one big union analysis. But regardless of that, well, I just lost the next point. Got me sidetracked. I'll come back to it. Sorry.
Well, I'm sure I'm not saying class is the only thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, it came back. Once you enter into those, the working class or the people are not monolithic, and their ideas aren't monolithic either. I think there's a real tendency, once we're radicals, to, like, see ourselves as, like, oh, we have to, like, you know, our ideas have to take a back seat to the people's. But the people's aren't just one big fucking idea either. The best thing I can come up with is being honest about my ideas, putting them out there, and arguing with them as far as, like, what our objectives and goals are, and have those people come. And I think what you'll usually find is those people really haven't thought about it, and that's exactly your idea of a vanguard. We have had some degree of privilege or experience or whatever that's allowed us to think about these things, and we can maybe develop a set of questions to help those people come up with their own ideas. Then we can debate them as different groups, and I like coming at it with a very clear ideological perspective of what I'm for, what I'm against, and have those people do the same, and then work from there, not like privileging some vanguard class because of their positionality within class, race, gender, whatever, but based on ideas and the objectives that you have.
You wonder what time it is?
It's about 35. Yeah.
Yeah, we're way over time. You know, don't sit here out of politeness for me. You can flee at any point.